sit pretty high up around 7,000 feet. Uh-huh. So I can't plant vegetables because the growing season is not long enough. So I can plant some flowers. And of course, the deer like to eat my tulips, but.
Other than that.
So in our house in New Mexico, uh-huh. which is in Santa Fe, which is at 7,000 mm-hmm. feet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There were always some rabbits who,
oh boy.
who lived in the neighborhood and
enjoyed the salad bar
just
or some
enjoyed
chesney.
Whatever everybody had out there.
Yeah.
And chipmunks also.
Wow.
But at any rate, and so now where were you head for?
Well, let me tell you what we've done. We left Park City, and we drove and had a night in Colorado Springs, where the next reunion is going to be held. And then we went on down to Abilene, Texas, where Dr. Williams is a professor. And we met the Cliff Dietz and his wife, Brandy, there. And for 3 weeks, Barbara and I worked on the computers and all the stuff he had, and were scanning things and arranging all the data he had over the last 8 years to get it on one disk. Cliff and Brandy joined us for 2 weeks, and of course there was Dr. Williams, and then so we put in over 800 hours working on all that stuff, like 10, 11 hour days. And then we packed up the car with about 8 to 10 boxes of various materials, including Stars and Stripes newspaper and Yanks magazine and Echoes and various other things have been collected, photos and whatever. And we drove on to Birmingham, Alabama, where she...
Now, where were all these things at?
At Abilene Christian University with Dr. Williams.
They had come from vets, you know, through the years of the 306.
Yeah, Russell Strong was the mm-hmm. only person I knew who was, I had met other people, but to me he was the...
Yeah, he was the honcho.
Yeah, he was the main guy, and he collected a tremendous and very nice collection of photos, correspondence, various other records, tower logs, operation reports.
And you've got his book.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And he wrote a nice note to me on the front of it because I helped him get a lot of names from the
veterans.
When you were
I was at VA.
Yeah. Anyway, so after he was no longer doing that, Al McMahon was secretary for 2 years, and then Barbara's been secretary ever since. And Dr. Williams has been the historian and has been writing the Echoes, so people were sending things to him. So now we've got all the stuff that he's had, and we've all taken it, we drove it down to the Mighty Eighth Museum there in Savannah, and actually Poole, Georgia, Pooler, after we went to a wedding in Birmingham, and I visited a lot of relatives in Atlanta, then we went on down to Savannah. And then we drove up and met Russell Strong's son, Bill.
That's his eldest son. 5 son.
And talked with him a bit.
He remembered your name. I said, I'm sure you remember his name because when Field was with the VA, he would have helped your dad with figuring out where a lot of these fellas were.
Yeah. So then we drove on a long trip on over
to Cookville.
What's the name of that little town? Cooksville?
Cookville. I-40 was closed in both directions.
And what?
I-40 was closed in both directions. Mm-hmm. We were counting on going through that real pretty part with the big sweeps, and they had closed it for slope control after all the rain Tennessee has been getting. And so we had to go about 100 miles out of the way up through the hills and all around. And it was just for yesterday, from 4 a.m. until midnight, that it would be closed.
But that was when we needed to go through.
Later than we thought.
Yeah, so that was a pretty big detour. So we didn't get in till like 9 o'clock.
Central.
10 o'clock Eastern. And then this morning we get up, we drive about 20 miles on the freeway, and it comes to a complete stop. So again, we got off the freeway and took local roads all the way here.
Yeah.
So we got to see the pretty state, the scenery.
So you came, I guess you came down 65 from Fresco or...
Well, we would have, but we were on US 231. And then came up US 231 from in Tennessee, and it looked like it was more of a straight line to Bowling Green.
Yeah, well, I had figured you would stay under normal circumstances, stay on Interstate 40 to
right.
Nashville.
Right.
And this way we avoided Nashville, and that's not bad. So it worked out.
Well, I was interested to hear you talking on the phone about you guys, apparently your family had some land you gave to Western Kentucky. I see you're wearing a shirt. So where is Western Kentucky?
Well, it's it's across town, most of it.
Yeah.
We can drive over to the campus, and we're very proud of.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the land that we get, because that's 15 miles away, that on Green River, which is also very nice.
Yeah. Has your family been here for a long time?
My father, and well, we first came here in 1927.
Okay.
I was almost 6 years old. My father was on the faculty at WKU, or Western Kentucky State Teachers College at that time.
Yeah.
And
what did he teach?
Foreign languages.
Okay.
And then he had, well, let's see. He had 6 children graduate from WKU.
All right.
Two families, really. The sister I talked about in Mayfield is a half sister. But my mother died when I was 14.
Okay.
And in the ninth grade, my father was 55 in 19. I don't know, it was about 9. About 5 years later, mm-hmm. about 6 years later, he was 55 and married a lady who was 24.
Oh. Wow.
31 years difference.
Wow.
And they had 3 more children.
Okay.
But anyway, yes, I have been here, and we lived right on the edge of the campus. And, well, I don't know, from that time on, when I was a little boy, I was considered that was all mine. And so everything that was going on over there had to do with me. And I left, well, got called into service when I was a senior in college.
Okay.
And came back 3 years later and finished up. I had a couple of semesters left under the GI Bill, and worked around here, newspaper reporter, and well, taught school for a year. But anyway, I left here in around 1950, and didn't come back until 03.
Oh, wow.
My wife was from Russellville, and we thought it would be nice to be near some of her folks.
Sure.
As we were getting older. I didn't have anybody left here, but she didn't want to live
So how'd you guys end up getting the land? That where you lived, or?
Well, it was something that my father had bought a long, long time ago, and he and my stepmother lived out there during a great part of World War II. Is what I'm trying to say. I wasn't at home. I never lived out there, and but at any rate, after he retired, they had moved back to Bowling Green, back to town, and when he retired, he needed further income. They didn't really have a retirement system at the at the college then. They had him on some kind of a retainer or something. But at any rate, he knew that with eight children, that there wasn't going to be anything. It was the only chance for us, the five of us and the older family. I had four sisters, and we worked out a deal. We bought the land from him.
Okay.
Each of us making a payment monthly, which worked out with
a bit of an income.
The goal that a lot of people have. Well, it's nice. We'll put up a cabin or an A-frame or something. All of us were living out of state at that time. And we'll get back there for homecoming or reunions, which, of course, never happened. And so about the time we were moving back here, it's 140 acres.
That's a lot of land.
With long river frontage on one of the prettiest rivers in the United States, really.
Wow.
So I suggested to my four sisters, why don't we give it to WKU? And I didn't really know anybody on campus then. But we worked. They did want it. That was the thing. And they did figure out. And my plan, my ambition for it even now is that every organization, every department, every discipline being taught on the campus might be able to find some way to use it. The possibility of trigonometry under the trees.
Sure.
After we gave it to them, of course, WKU is in the same position, I guess, most all state universities are in the United States. They don't have any money. The legislature has quit funding. It's a state university, and about 17% of its operating funds come from the state.
Which
means they're having to raise tuition every year.
Yeah.
And it's just really getting difficult for kids to go to school.
It is.
It costs over $10, this is not an elite school by any means. Wednesday. It costs over $10,000 a year.
Wow.
For some kid coming out of high school to register.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how big a school is it?
That's 22,000, I think.
Well, that's a good size.
And they do interesting things, but I guess all universities do now. But it seems to me that the president and various other people spend a lot of time in China lately, and they've got a lot of foreign students on the campus, which is good financially.
Right.
In fact, within the last 3 years, I guess, they finally knocked down the house that I grew up in, where my parents built it in 1929, but we had no ownership of it for many years. In fact, there was a sorority house at last, which led me to tell people that there had always been a sorority house. I grew up with four sisters.
A lot of truth to that.
So did you get that, Barbara got the stuff posted on the internet site for the fellows in London or in England, and do you need any help getting the rest of that thing done?
I got help from the university.
Oh, good.
Donald Smith, who is president of the College Heights Foundation, which is the entity that. That you write checks to when you want to make
right.
a donation, and I have done that two or three times. At any rate, he was a good friend, and I asked him if there was some way I could get somebody on the campus to type it, so he came to the house and picked it up, and we talked about it, and got it back, and his secretary got the response, which is here, and I've got a copy if you all want it.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's see.
Oh, yes, that turned out beautiful. Thank you for your recent letter and for considering it.
Want me to read it?
Thank
you for your recent letter and for considering me as a representative of the B-17 radio operators in our missions against Germany in World War II. My first inclination was to decline to respond, citing the fact that I never really functioned as a radio operator in the 10 missions I flew. We had complete radio silence. I never touched a key, spoke a word, but I listened, but that was all. Also, there's the fact that the first nine missions were largely uneventful. We delivered a load of bombs with little challenge and then came home. The Luftwaffe had little strength left. A lot of other radio men could tell museum goers more interesting stories and show their training, that their training, skill, and valor played a big part in our victory. In short, it seems to me you can make a more representative choice, although I realize after 70 years, the list of eligibles is a fraction of what it used to be.
Maybe the best man.
That's right. So I'll tell you about our 10th mission. No radio involvement here either, but a little activity that may be interesting. The day was February 14th, 1945, Valentine's Day. The target was Dresden. Much has been made of the fact that we and the RAF decided to hit a city that had been spared so far and was considered by many to be of negligible strategic value. We were told in the briefing that morning that our mission was requested by the Soviet High Command in support of their armies then entering Eastern Germany. We were provided special identification in case we were downed and came into contact with Soviet troops, a plastic card with the American flag on one side and a message in Cyrillic on the reverse. When we got to the target, trouble developed when part of the formation failed to drop its bombs and we had to make a second pass. We were attacked by three FW-190s, the first enemy planes our crew had seen. We were hit by one and then knocked out of formation. From my location in the radio room, I could see nothing and only knew what was happening by intercom conversation. I then smelled an explosion and saw that it had torn some holes in my compartment. There was no further electronic communication. I saw that Frank McDonough, waist gunner, had been hit badly in the legs. I opened the bomb bay door to see if I could see or reach anyone in the front of the plane. The bomb bay was full of flames. I then went back to Frank. I found his parachute for him and helped him hook it up and get out of the plane. I then hooked up my own chute and prepared to leave. I saw that Al Lubajacki, ball turret gunner, had pulled the turret up and was about to get out of it, but he appeared to be in distress. I have regretted ever since I did not check on him before I bailed out, although it's doubtful that I could have helped. He left the plane, but apparently died of wounds shortly thereafter. My landing was near a little lake, or more likely a pond, close enough to it that part of my chute was in the water. I had no idea where I was, and I still don't know if I was in Germany or Czechoslovakia. At any rate, a great number of citizens seemed to resent my being there. By the time I got out of my chute and stood up and looked around, a large committee seemed to be gathering. I sensed that they were not there to give me the key to the city or invite me to speak at the Rotary Club. I stood with my hands held high, but the first greeter seemed not to recognize my peaceful attitude and my lack of weapon or threatening body language. He backhanded me across the face several times. Some blood spilled, but nothing serious. As the crowd moved in, a young soldier stepped up and took me as his prisoner. I was glad to see him. He commandeered a truck being driven by a young man and his girlfriend. I was squeezed in the front next to the girl and the soldier on the running board. He directed the driver to take us to a nearby police station. While sitting in the station, I found out that Germans really didn't answer the phone by saying Heil Hitler, just as they did in Hollywood pictures. I also learned that they didn't like me very much.
Really did answer the phone, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, really did answer the phone, right. Sorry. I also learned they didn't like me very much. A man and his little boy came in to see this evil person. The boy was crying because he was afraid of me. His father spit on me and left. The police station was the first stop of several that day as my captors tried to figure out what to do with me. At each place I was interrogated, often it seemed by people showing off, a school teacher and several security personnel. When I provided only name, rank, and serial number, they reminded me that I was a long way from home and in serious trouble. They also reminded me that I was only an enlisted man and couldn't give them information that was important. We don't ask secrets from sergeants. During these activities, I had been turned over to two Luftwaffe non-coms as escorts. Finally, after dark, they took me to a jail where I was to spend a couple of days. My escorts picked me up one evening, and we got on a train for Frankfurt on Main for official interrogation and processing. For the next 2 days, we were crowded into a compartment with civilians heading west. At first, I felt a little uncomfortable when we were under air raid alerts with B-17s overhead. And when we pulled off on a siding by the hospital train full of wounded German troops. However, my fellow passengers seemed to have their own problems and paid little attention to me. At Frankfurt, I saw one or two of my crew members, and although we were not allowed to communicate, knowing they had survived was good news. After Frankfurt, there followed a number of moves over the next couple of months. Most of my captivity was spent on the road with hundreds of other prisoners as Germans tried to avoid our liberation by American troops. My POW days ended at Moosburg one bright Sunday morning, April 29th, as American tanks moved in. So I was a radio operator who never touched a key or twisted a knob, but I was there and available. Maybe my greatest contribution was keeping two of the enemy occupied for several days after I was captured.
There you go.
The Luftwaffe knocked us out of the air, but I was able to, in effect, capture two of their nine comms for a short period. Thanks for thinking of me. I appreciate and applaud what you are doing to perpetuate the memory of what our countries did together so long ago. It's an effort that must be continued, and I will help if I can. And sincerely. Wonderful letter. You have a nice bit of humor.
That's nice. Thank you. It reminded me that I wanted to ask you regarding B.B. Lewis, your pilot on that day. Had he been pilot of your missions for several missions? Or?
Yeah. Ted... Ted Strawn.
Uh-huh.
He was from Oklahoma, and Lou Wilson, the guy from who was the navigator at Logansport, Indiana. They were killed flying with another crew, which,
right.
which I'm that sure you know about that.
January.
Yes, right away. Boston B. Lewis from Clearfield, Utah. Although I think he was originally from Louisiana. I think that Utah was just a military address. But at any rate, from the very start, he flew all 10 missions.
Oh, okay.
Now, that was not true of our navigator. We had several navigators from time to time.
Had he previously been a pilot of a different kind of aircraft?
I think so, yeah. He was, and he was older than Ted, the original pilot, was. I think I was the oldest man on the crew at that time. I would have been 22 when we got together. Almost 22. Well, no, almost 23. But at any rate, Ted was younger than I, about 2 or 3 months, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that Lewis, our...
Boston, yeah.
Yeah. I'm confusing him with the navigator a little bit. I think that he was, I think he was over 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure about that, but...
That was an old man for a crew, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And he may not, I know that he was several years older than the rest of us at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas, Little Jackie was 19, so was McDonough, as I recall, and so was Lou Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a second lieutenant.
Wow.
And the other with the other crew member, the other fellow up front, Joe Sickard, the bombardier, was a flight officer. He was not commissioned, but he was also on the 19.
And Bob Whitelaw was the co-pilot.
Yeah, he may have been. He may have been a little bit older than I have, but I'm trying to think. Either he or I were the oldest, and and this all happened, I think, when I was 23 years old. And I say when this all happened, when? See, we were together less than a year. Our crew met in at Drew Field in Tampa, Florida, in I guess it was late August of 1944. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that phone is. Friend calling, but I'm going to let her.
Oh, okay.
She'll probably leave me a message in a minute. And we had been shot down, and we'd been overseas and been through combat, and back home by the next June.
Wow. So less than a year.
Not back home to stay, except it amounted to that because the war was over in a couple of months. I was back here in Bowling Green expecting to go into some kind of training on B-29s, and suddenly, while I was still on furlough, the war ended.
Wow.
I was just reminiscing on the short period of time that we were really really around, and only prisoners for 2.5 months or something like that,
which was a blessing.
And
so I'm curious, when the Americans approached, did the Germans just walk out and leave? They knew they were coming, they just left, huh? They didn't say anything, just left?
That weekend, there were, I can't remember whether it was the 13th Armored or 14th Armored, from Fort Knox down the lake, came in that morning. I'll say Friday, which would have been the 27th of May, they had started drifting away. And I remember Saturday night, I had not participated in this. I was pretty conservative. I thought the war could flare up at any time, and really was not very brave about trying to break out or anything of the sort. But by Saturday night, prisoners had torn up just a great deal of the interior fences that would separate one compound from another. And remember that picture, that poor German guard, and this one was quite young, as I recall, with just a sad look on his face and a gun on his shoulder, marching up and down where the fence had been, nobody afraid of him. Mm-hmm. But the next morning, when the tanks came in, there was some diehard, and when the guardhouses fired at a tank, and I don't know what they used, but they moved a gun around there and just blasted the thing out of the way.
Wow.
Just killed some people unnecessarily, seemed to me. Mm. And then by that afternoon, I didn't go into the town, Mooseburg. Mm-hmm. A lot of people did, just kind of streamed out of the camp. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it was they had kept moving us south, and that was down at the bottom end, the edge of Germany, way down in Bavaria, mm-hmm. and gone about as far as they could go. Mm-hmm. And but there were just thousands of people there, no real arrangements anymore. People sleeping on the ground and so on. Yeah. And big Russian or Soviet compound. Mm-hmm. And as I should say, that I didn't leave. I didn't, been here this long. Mm-hmm. We'll wait and see what happens. And by the next day, the place was pretty well occupied by active troops. Mm-hmm.
And American.
Yeah. I'm not saying pretty well occupied. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I mean is there was arming them around.
Right.
A lot of them around.
Not a whole lot of troops, but
right.
With tanks and so on, we knew it was over. Mm-hmm. Although there was nobody there to make any
announcements
about it.
Yeah.
And then that afternoon, the Soviets, and I have no idea how they arranged this or where it all came from, but they had a little band. I don't know where they got their instruments from, but at any rate, there was a gathering over at the edge of their compound. They played the Star Spangled Banner, and the National is National, I guess.
Right.
I mean, I think that's what it was. I don't really recall it. I haven't heard it before. Mm-hmm. It shows up. We got to introduce General George Patton.
Oh, my.
Wow.
And in all of his splendor with his pearl-handled pistols and shiny helmet and well-pressed uniform and all that. We were quite pleased to see him, and we were just a messy. You can imagine. Nobody really had paying much attention to uniforms. For one thing, you didn't. I never did have any shoes that would fit me. Mm-hmm. And as a prisoner, I was given a very nice, to me, looked expensive and good English leather boots. But this was at a supply room at an early prison camp. Wetzlar, I believe, which I appreciated. Previously, although I was still wearing those flying boots, which, but they had to take a razor blade and cut the toes. Very nice
Micron,
shoe.
Right?
Probably the best shoes I'd ever had in my life. Well, nobody looked like the military personage that that you associate with George Patton, and I was so surprised that one of his main points was complimenting us on the military manner. And I know one thing, I was wearing a Russian cap that I had traded with one of their prisoners. And it didn't fit me, but I wanted it. And it seems to me I had a Canadian blouse or something. But
cobbled together.
Yeah, but at any rate, and we were, well.
So what did Patton have to say?
Well, he was, that's mainly it. He was congratulating, saying how glad he was to, I don't know whether he announced the end of the war. Well, he didn't, because I don't think the war ended for another day. But I really don't recall what he had to say, except that he looked about 6.5 feet tall.
Wow.
And I know that he wasn't. He was,
right.
He was fairly short, and but he was very resplendent in his attire and in his personage. At any rate, we were glad to see him. And,
so how long did it take him to get you out of there?
I think it was about 4 or 5 days. They moved us out to Lanzhut. There was a landing strip there, a landing field, and I really don't know how far that was from Mooseburg, but by that time there were trucks in there and
carrying you. That
loaded way. Us up and took us to Lanzhut, and we sat around the grass for a while, and every now and then a C-40, I can't recall, a C-46 or C-47 would come in and pick up a load. So
the weather was pretty nice by that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was it they were flying you guys?
We took us to Reims.
Okay.
And there, we got, thing I noticed, mainly the cathedral had sandbags around it. It was just well protected, it seemed to me. I'd never seen anything like that, the amount. But at any rate, there were pretty little girls on the streets throwing flowers at us in the trucks.
Wow.
And just very nice. Certainly something more than we expected. And what we didn't know at that time, and found out later, that Reims was a place where they they had just that day had signed the, I don't want to use the word armistice because
that's surrender.
Surrender.
Uh-huh. Unconditional surrender, yeah.
Wow.
And who was it? Admiral Admiral Dönitz? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
German.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know that, but any rate, it dreams, and we got on a train and took us to Camp Lucky Strike, which is which was filled with ex-prisoners,
sure,
people from all over, and I don't know, we were around there for several days.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I remember was they were trying to fatten you up, and and in a little clearing there, I've forgotten where it was, there was a big kettle full of eggnog.
Oh, wow.
And by that time we had canteen cups, and you could go down there and get a cup full of eggnog.
Wow. So what were they feeding you to try to fatten you up?
Regular fare.
I mean, rations, or were they actually cooking stuff?
No, I think we had got some hot meals there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we got back to the States, first came in at Hampton Roads, Virginia, and the mess hall there had, you would go through a line, and there would be milk for you at the beginning of the line and again at the end.
Okay.
You were encouraged to drink a pint or a half pint, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
on your way through the line. But one morning there, I went down to this central place, I forgot what it was, but where the eggnog was, and well, it would have been on headquarters for a normal organization, I guess, and everybody was excited. General Eisenhower had just been there.
Oh, wow.
I didn't see him.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow.
I found out about it. And he had his hands in his pockets and an unsoldierly attitude or gesture. And it was just very friendly.
Much more casual than
Patton.
Wow.
So when you got back, who did you see? Any family? At some point, they learned you were alive and okay, I guess.
This is. I've often thought about this. I didn't think of it much about them. But a really real story of the personal I don't want to say suffering, but the things that you read about and letters home and so on.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when I left. When the last thing I did before I went, we had a, got a furlough for about a week before going overseas. Mm-hmm. And I had spent a day or two in Chicago visiting a girl that I was, we were very much in love and we were expecting to do something about it when I got back from at the end of the war. We had met here in school and dated for a couple of years, and her older brother was very close friend of mine, and we exchanged letters and so on.
Sure.
Very promptly and reliably, but at any rate, when I got to where I was, while we can, and I'm talking about England,
right,
Thurlow. I would still hear from her quite often. Then we got shot down. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't wait to get back, reestablish contact, and get on with our lives. I called her from Hampton Roads when we got in. She sounded a little different. And I said, well, if something happened, what's... She said, yes. And she told me she wanted me to come and see her. Things were different. Well, what had happened was she reestablished contact with the fellow she was going with before she met me.
Oh.
And she made a wise choice. I even thought that then, because he was very reliable and I wasn't. But he was still in service, but he had not gone overseas. And at any rate, she had written me a Dear John letter.
Oh, but you hadn't gotten it.
I had not gotten it. Mm. She got returned to her marked missing in action. You know, grief
right
there, and disappointment, worry.
Sure.
You know, that's the war. In the meantime, my father had got the word from the War Department, missing in action, and well, it was after VE Day that they knew that I was still alive. But at any rate, he was on the campus here, and Marianne, the girl that I was talking about, had a younger sister, Frances, who was a student here, and my father went over to her dormitory and told her that he'd got this letter, I mean this telegram, so she could let Marianne know. And all this going on, and then he had to spend the rest of it, and this was, I don't know, early in March, I think, when he had to spend the next 2 or 3 months with uncertainty, not knowing where I was, what was happening to me, just as the Lubjacki family did, and so on.
And all the others.
And all the others. And then, and they were living out on the land that we're talking about, and no telephone. You couldn't get a telephone during the wartime.
Right.
And, well, no electricity either. But at any rate, he knew nothing until one day several days after the war was over, which would have been into May. He said that a lady drove up from town, the Red Cross lady, and he said she was so excited that she hollered at him before she got out of the car. Good news. And so he was relieved, and that was great. And then there was a continuation of this story, which to this day bothers me, and I get emotional about it, and I've told it to other people, and they get emotional. But at any rate, he went to class, his first class tonight, the next morning. Somebody had gotten the same word, had found out that I was alive, and so on. And when and when he walked in, and of course they had known what was going on all spring, and some of the people in the class I had known, I had been a steward. But at any rate, when he walked in, they gave him a standing ovation. And he broke up and had to dismiss the class.
That's great.
And it's still, it's still got an emotional pull.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Which is parts of the happenings and the vicissitudes of war.
Yeah.
Exactly. Wow.
But at any rate, I was just saying that our family saw our little part of it.
Yeah. Right. You betcha.
Yes.
Well, are you interested in any kind of lunch?
Well, I think it'd be a good idea.
All right.
You got any suggestions?
No, not really.
Well,
what are some of the choices around? I got the car right out here. What are some of the choices?
Well, I don't know how much time you want to spend, what the plans are. I started to ask a while ago what you're going to do from here.
Well, we're going to have to drive about 100 miles to distant relative of Barbara's
in Louisville.
Oh.
But we told her that
she's expecting us in time for dinner and to spend the night.
We're not in a big rush.
Well, there's the Red Lobster and all those.
That'd be fine.
Right down the road on Scottsville Road. Rafferty's, Old Charlie's.
Have you got a preference?
No.
Well, Red Lobster would be fine with me.
Okay. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put on some long pants.
Okay.
I'll get cold in there.
Well, I know what you mean. A lot of these places are air conditioned too much.
By any chance have a copy of Mr. Delaney's letter?
No, I don't.
Could we?
Well, I know what you mean. A lot of these places air conditioned too much.
Do you by any chance have a copy of Mr. Delaney's letter?
No, I don't.
Could we